Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel. I'm so glad you're here today. I'm so happy. I've waited some years for this conversation. We've got Jay Platt here in the studio. Jay, welcome to Living Writers.
Oh, thank you, T. Thank you very much for asking.
It's so good to have you here, and thanks for coming down to the studio on a rainy October.
October, feeling like November.
It got here quick when it decided to come, didn't it? We've got Jason behind the glass. Thanks to Reverend Andrew for another super program leading up to us, and to DJ Lamb Chop before the Rev. Today, I just wanted to say before Jay Platt and I start talking about his incredible West Side Bookshop, that this show is dedicated to Jim Manheim, who we all know around here, and that's how I first met him, as Tex. Tex died earlier this month, and he was someone who will always be part of the Living Writers family and WCBN, and he's very missed. So this one's going out to you, Tex. Jay, you have exciting things coming up this weekend with the Antiquarian Book Fair, and we have the 50th anniversary of West Side Bookshop, the bookshop that you started back in 1975. This is just, and it started on September 21st.
September 21st. Actually, it took us 1 month to open, but the time I signed a lease and we built the bookshelves, or I had a business partner at the time, which I bought out a couple of years
later.
And
this was Fred? Was this Fred?
No.
No. Oh, sorry. Okay.
No.
I'll let you tell the stories.
Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, that was, we had a business partner, and he would, we put up some money. He put up a little bit of money. I put up some books. Mm. And we borrowed $3,000 from the bank. And that's what we started with. And it took us a month to build the bookshelves and open up. And the first day, we made our rent the first day. We had kind of an opening celebration. So that was, and a lot of my friends came in and bought books.
And when you say, you put up the books, you had been collecting books
right,
for a while, like for some years.
Well, I think a lot of book dealers start as book collectors. You get the bug of it's hard to explain it. You can't really teach it, but it's just something you said, oh, I like the feel of an old book. And then you start learning about them, and you go to book sales, you start looking at a lot of books. And it's still, as I tell people, every day I see a book I've never seen before. And I've been doing it for over 50 years.
Every day, Jay?
Just about, yeah. Every day.
Because I've even seen you, I've bumped into you back when, was it called Value Village? Like over where Plum Market is now.
Right, yes.
And you'd be like, I was looking in the books, and you were looking in the books too. You were in their book area to see if they had any books.
Occasionally, yeah. I go to places like that. There's no single source where we can find books, so we have to go. I do buy a lot of estates. That's where most of the books come from.
Estate sales.
Estates too, where I get a call, what we call house calls. Yeah, and but I go to book sales, not as many as I used to, and auctions occasionally, and I travel quite a bit for books. I've gone as far as Colorado and Connecticut and Florida to buy collections, so especially in my area. I specialize in books on polar exploration, so I do travel quite a bit for those.
And how did the polar exploration, how did that passion start for you to become your area?
Yeah, it's kind of, I probably trace it back to probably in high school. I read a book called Endurance by Alfred Lansing, which is about Shackleton's boat journey from Elephant Island to South Georgia. And I just got fascinated by that. I've read it three or four times since. And it's anyway, so it probably got started that way. And I've always been interested in remote places, remote islands, things like that. So that's probably where it got started. I didn't really start collecting or start buying it until probably the early 1970s. And I started building up a collection of books on polar exploration. And that back then, you could get catalogs. I mean, you could look in the New York Times book review section. There'd be a list of dealers that were offering catalogs, and you could order them. And I ordered every catalog I could get. And that's how you kind of learn what other dealers are asking for things. There are fewer catalogs today, but that was really kind of the lifeblood of the book trade at that time.
The catalogs.
Catalogs,
yeah. When I was reading some interviews, you've been interviewed before, Jay Platt, stranger to an interview here. Where you had to learn a bit on the fly because you went to New York City to book our Fourth Avenue.
Yes, well, that goes back to about 1970. And a friend was with me and we were in New York City. And he was in the bookstores, and so we went around on Fourth Avenue, which was called Booksellers Row, and a lot of used bookstores are going back from 1900 or so. They've been there forever. They're almost all gone now. But we went into the bookshop. He asked for a book which I'd never heard of before, and the dealer went way up in the stack someplace and found it. And I said, how did he know where it was? And I said, well, now I know. I can find a book at the bottom of a pile in the shop. I said, I know where it is. It's right there.
Yeah.
It's sometimes you, not always, but I got the bug at that time. And I said, boy, this is neat. I really like it. And that's what I want to do. And I started working in bookstores. First at a textbook. I actually worked in textbooks for a while at the old student book service on South U, which is long gone, and then at Ned's bookstore in Ypsilanti. But then I was also worked at David's Books when I had a big book emporium back in, this is 73, 74.
Emporium.
Yeah. Well, David Kotzebue, who had David's Books at that time, was quite a character. And I kind of learned, he was no businessman, but I learned what not to do. And I got hired as the kind of the rare book department, which, I had some experience, but not very much. It was like just diving right in. And David had bought this big collection in Detroit, and I was in charge of pricing it. And I didn't, so I was handling books that were, I haven't seen since. I mean, a lot of signed limited editions, good literature and things like that. So you're just diving right in and learning it.
And the catalogs then, because that's when the catalogs were useful too. Were they out there is that part of the learning curve that you were mentioning?
Oh, yeah. You mentioned as I said, also, well, looking at catalogs, but also looking at a lot of books, so going to book sales, you have the more books you look at, and you kind of develop a visual memory of what to look for. And now sometimes I look at a collection, and the common books just kind of fade in the background. And then when I see something I haven't seen before or looks very interesting, I can pick it out pretty quickly. Yeah.
And when you haven't seen a book before, what does that mean for you? Because when you say it's almost daily, you see a book you've never seen before.
Right.
Can you?
I mean, they're not all rare books, but they're sort of just a title I haven't seen before. Yeah.
Yeah. So it could be as simple as that. Like, it doesn't have to necessarily be like a book that's like a rare book, but right. It could be.
It could be, yes. And I made some interesting finds. I mean, books that have at book sales occasionally. There was this book I bought at a book sale here in town. This is in 1976, maybe 77, thereabouts. And on their the book sale had a rare book table, special books. And on it was a big album of photographs. And it said Swiss and Roman on it. And it was $15. And I said, that's got to be worth at least $100. So I picked it up, and it turned out that they were photographs taken by the Swiss or the Alpine photographs were taken by these two French photographers, the Bisson brothers. And these were some of the first alpine pictures of photography in the Alps in the 1850s. And it sold, it sold for about $6,000. I did break it up and sold it individually, but still, boy, I wish I had it back.
Gosh, that's incredible, too. Oh, what a find.
Yeah, that's what keeps you going sometimes, just knowing you never know what's going to come across, what we call coming across the transom or going to an estate or an auction or whatever.
And does it feel like, what does it feel like when you, does it ever feel like you're matchmaking? Like you find something and then you find the person who really wants it as well.
Well, hopefully, eventually, yes. Yeah. There's still the collector in me. So I just, this is my library, but I have to sell a few occasionally to
really
pay the rent.
So part of you does want to hold on to as much as you can.
I'm sorry?
So part of you wants to hold onto as many of the finds as you can, the collector.
For a while. After a while, I say, well, that's time to move on. So I don't collect anymore, but I do.
Except the polar exploration.
I don't keep it. But I will. I'm actually kind of building up a collection because I bought a number of collections, some locally and actually some. I mentioned one in Colorado and one in Florida. One in Connecticut, both interesting, and they, I used to issue catalogs. I did about 33 catalogs just on polar exploration, and that's where.
Wow.
I mean, there are two reasons, obviously, to sell books to a catalog, but also later on they're going to want to dispose of their library, so they have my catalog and they'll contact me.
Oh, so it might return to you then.
Yes, and they come back, and this happened actually the. Collector in Connecticut, East Lyme, Connecticut, if I recall correctly, and he had quite an Antarctic collection, and he had contacted me. I'd been selling to him, and now he was time to, move on, and so I drove out there, and he had a very incredible collection. I mean, it was very good, and he'd been to the Antarctic. And he had climbed. He was also a mountain climber and climbed with Hillary.
Whoa.
And so we were talking. And but he also collected. This is interesting. He editions of Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham. That was his. And he had a whole bookcase of all different editions of Wind in the Willows. That's one of my favorite books too.
Well, and I know because that's one of your areas in the shop too, the children's literature.
Oh, of course, yeah,
And so Wind in the Willows is one of your favorite.
Oh, one of my favorites, yes.
But it's,
and it's a book you can read aloud. It's a book that's meant to be read aloud, I think, because that's when he wrote it. He was stories that he told to his children, and they, and he made up these characters and everything, and they. But it's a very oral book in that sense.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah. And did you read it to your kids? Did you read it to your kids, Jay?
Yes, I did, and to various girlfriends over the years too.
Oh, so multiple uses. Yeah. Wind in the Willows.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We'll take a short break, and then maybe we'll come back and let's rewind a little bit to talk about young Jay Platt. Coming to Ann Arbor in 1963.
Okay.
Okay. Today on Living Writers, Jay Platt is here in the studio. We've got the Ann Arbor Antiquarian Book Fair on the horizon this Sunday, October 26th, 11 to 5, at the Michigan Union, the ballroom on the second floor. Jay has been running this for years, and we'll talk more about it later in the program. And the West Side Bookshop. Just one of the best places you'll ever find in Ann Arbor in the world, I hazard to say, or in my opinion. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back.
Okay.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers on WCBN-FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel. I'm so glad you're joining us here today. Today, Jay Platt is here in the studio. Jay is the owner and the bookseller at Westside Bookshop here in Ann Arbor. And also will be actually will be creating and holding the 45th annual Ann Arbor Antiquarian Book Fair this coming weekend, Sunday, October 26th at the Michigan Union. But the Westside Bookshop is 50 years old.
Hard to believe, but yes.
Yeah. It must be hard to believe.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get in that time machine.
Okay.
Because otherwise I'll just start talking about the bookshop and you won't get me off that, Jay. But yes, so young Jay Platt applies to the University of Michigan.
I did.
But you were born in Michigan.
I was born in Traverse City, 1944. My father was a naval aviator and there was a naval air station there. And he was testing gliders and all. Anyway, that was during the war. But when I came to Ann Arbor, I had never been to Ann Arbor before. Well, I think one time I took a bus from, I grew up in the Alexandria or in the Washington, D.C. area. And when I was 14, I took a bus up to St. Ignace where we have a cottage. I was going to stay with my grandmother in 1959. And I did pass through Ann Arbor. But other than that, I'd never been to it before. And, you know, I applied to Michigan, MIT, and the University of Virginia. And that's all. I'd never been to, well, I've been to UVA, but I didn't travel. I just knew I kind of liked the idea of being in Michigan. It was in engineering. I got my degree in naval architecture in ship design. And I just like boats and I like to sail. And I don't sail as much as I used to. But anyway, so I came here and I had never been, I came here. I think I took a bus here from, I came for orientation, which was in August of 63, and stayed in the dorm. It was like a week or something like that. I don't remember. And then came back. I remember taking a bus, and I came to the old bus Greyhound bus station on Huron. West Huron Street. And I said, you know, I got a cab, and I said, take me to East Quad, wherever that is. And I said, all I had was a Foot Locker. So all my stuff was in one Foot Locker. I mean, now people bring their whole, you know, they visit dozens of campuses and, you know, and bring a whole household full of stuff. Everything was in one Foot Locker. And
that's how you got your start here in Ann Arbor,
that
basically.
Was it. Yeah. I didn't like it at first. The first year I was here, I almost transferred out. And then I.
Why? What was it, Jay?
I don't know. I was just. I was probably homesick, you know. But I'm still here.
It became home.
Yes. Yeah. But, and that was, you know, I was. Another interesting thing about that year was on my 19th birthday was the day Kennedy was shot. I was 11-22-63. So that was quite, I remember that very, I mean, you remember things like that. I was on my way to a chemistry lecture, and I think it was in the Nat Sci building, and there was a sign on the, somebody make a handwritten sign on the door saying Kennedy shot. He hadn't died yet. And I remember the professor went on right on with the lecture. You know, I don't think he was a Kennedy fan. People forget that Kennedy wasn't all that popular.
Yeah.
I mean, there were people that, you know, but anyway.
It was a different
time, where things
people just kept going.
But they had
some of
the guys in the dorm put on a birthday party for me. Three or four. I mean, I don't know how they found it was my birthday. But anyway, it was interesting. It was a strange time.
Such a strange, strange day.
And then after that, I moved into, I was in the dorm the first year and then moved into an apartment. And then in sophomore year, I had a room right near campus and for $40 a month.
And those were the days.
And then in my senior year, I got a private room with a bathroom, a balcony. It was in an old mansion off of Washtenaw.
Oh wow!
And it was $9 a week, and it was a great. Wow. Those were the days. And then you got that by word of mouth. I mean, you know, it's just so.
Yeah. Ann Arbor is so changing now, isn't it, Jay?
Oh, yes. It's a lot different. I feel like a stranger. I go into some of the buildings. And and one thing I liked about naval architecture, at least the department at that time, was that it really hadn't changed a whole lot. We were doing things. So I'm kind of a traditionalist in that kind of effect. We were doing things what we call line drawings, where we were drawing what's called fairing the lines of a ship's hull. Ooh. We were doing it the same way it had been for over 100 years. And I still have that drawing. It took a whole semester to do. I mean, it's big. So they don't do that anymore. It's all done by a computer and stuff like that. Mm. But I just, and I like boats. I like old boats.
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm a boat nerd. I like the lake freighters. I like the old, So anyway, that.
Yes. And so, Jay, also, you had mentioned before we came on air, that you also heard WCBN early on the dorm.
In the dorms. It was only, it wasn't broadcast, but it was, I'm not sure what you call it, but it was, you had to have you could get it in your room. I forgot how we got it. I mean,
I think they were saying that with the walls were wired.
Yeah,
I think,
the walls
somehow
were wired. And the phone system, they called it Centrix. And I forgot that was due that year. And I'm not sure what it was different because they had one phone in each room. So anyway.
Because this is your first time down to the station.
But I hope
it won't be the last.
Oh,
but,
okay.
So Jay, when you were saying that, we were both saying how Ann Arbor is so different. From your perspective, you've seen a lot of change from like 1963 to now.
Yeah.
But the building itself that West Side Bookshop was in was almost taken down, the Harar building.
Well, yes. Back in the history, the building has an interesting history. It was built in 1888, and it was there was a photography studio. Before that, there was a wooden structure that was a photography studio, and then the Harar, H-A-A-R-R-A-R, something like that, building, and they, I think when they, he won some kind of lottery, and they had this building built, I think it cost like, someone told me $40,000, maybe that's what they won. It's an incredible building, because they imported marble from Italy for the fireplace upstairs, and a lot of, anyways, just a neat, and they had a photography studio there.
In the back room.
In the back room. And matter of fact, in the what is now the bathroom, it was actually where they did the developing, and there's what's called amber glass in the window. So yellow, so you
to filter out
something
the light.
To do with your photography, for the lighting. Yeah. Anyway, and they had they would do what are called carte de visite. DVZs. Anyway, your portraits and things like that. And I can still find some of those occasionally. I've got. Anyway, but they also had a bookstore in there too. So the building has an interesting, the connection. Could we have a photography studio, or not a studio, but a gallery? And Doug Price, has been with me for 45 years,
wow.
It seems, 40 years. And so it's kind of a continuation in the history of the building.
Because that back room, Doug Price has it set up so that there's huge, beautiful, like sepia photos, by Edward Curtis.
Edward S. Curtis.
And
Native American or American Indian photos from the early part of the century.
Beautiful, incredible work. And people can come and see it, but you could also buy them if you want to. And so many beautiful old typewriters, too.
Yes, we do. It's amazing how many.
Quite a trade.
We've sold probably over 200 typewriters since Doug started carrying. So he's become kind of an expert on typewriters. So it's kind of neat. I mean, a lot of people are buying them. They use them. I mean,
I do.
Yeah, and people still, I know some writers that still swear by typewriters. They said, and I remember when I was young in high school, I took typing. I don't know. I think my mother signed me up for it, and I didn't know. But it was, it's become useful. It's become very useful. But I made a comment to her, and I said, "Boy, you think a little bit differently when you type as opposed to handwriting." And that's probably true with computers. You think a little bit differently.
You do.
But I said, she said, no, that's not. Yeah, I think it is. I think it is true. Yeah.
It's very true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone out there listening, you can try it. It's very cool.
Yeah.
You might even find yourself writing some poems.
Yeah, there you go.
But you were saying, Jay, describing the shop too, because then the front part of the shop was a bookstore back in the beginning too.
Yeah.
And
there's somewhere, there's a sign that was in the front window. Excuse me. It said, John Harrer, Deutschen Buchhändler. We killed German books because the old West Side was heavily German. Ann Arbor is a big German town, especially, well, there was a lot more town and gown. I mean, even when I was in school, you rarely came downtown. I mean, maybe to drink. Because you couldn't, there were no bars on campus back then, so you had to go down to the old Peabel, there was a lot of bars in that area where the bookshop is. A lot of bars there, and there were some that were very towny bars. Students didn't go to, and some were more friendly to students. So, And that's changed. And now, and there were a lot, another thing has changed about downtown and Ann Arbor in general, I think. There's a lot more food restaurants and less retail than there used to be. Yeah.
Right. Because there used to be a department store, and that's why they were going to tear down your building another parking lot.
Yeah, the Klein's store, department store. And they still call it the Klein's lot, the parking lot behind the shop. And they said,
Jay, do you want some water?
No. So at one point, they wanted to tear down that block, the block that I'm in, which includes what's called the Walker Building, which is where the Arts Center is now. And they wanted to tear it down and expand that parking lot. And luckily, some professors here in the architecture school and Kingsbury Marzoff, who was the architect here, an architecture school, Doug Crary, who was head of the geography department, and they were very interested in Ann Arbor history, and they formed a group and got the building designated as a historic building, and fortunately stopped it. And so this was like in early 70s. In 1974, the building was used as the Ann Arbor sesquicentennial headquarters. And that's where, you know, a big year-long celebration, actually published a monthly publication, and all in that building, in that room where the bookshop is now. And I'm surprised, you know, because they made a big deal of the sesquicentennial, the bicentennial. I didn't sense the same excitement about it. Who knows?
But then it was a year later in 1975 in the summer when you were walking down the street and you saw the for rent sign.
Yes, commercial space for rent. And I said, that's it. And Joe and Carolyn Arkeor had just bought the building in June. Back in April of that year, I got a tour of the building from the city because the city owned the building at the time. And so, you know, I got the upstairs was a mess. but excuse me a minute. Yeah. But and the building sold for it was a closed bid auction, and it sold for like $42,000. And they fit some work, got to fix it up. They got the floors refinished, I know the city put in a new boiler. And so the city had done some, and the Arkeors did some. And though I signed a lease in August, mid-August of 1975, and opened this about a month later.
Yeah, so, and built the bookshelves in there. And and it's so much about your bookshop, Jay, West Side Bookshop, is is about the space itself, the yes. place itself.
Yeah.
So thank you for telling us the history. We'll take a short break now, and then we'll come back.
Okay.
Stay on Living Writers. Jay Platt is here. This coming Sunday, we've got the Ann Arbor Antiquarian Book Fair, Sunday, October 26th at the Michigan Union. Today, we're talking about the 50 years of West Side Bookshop with Jay Platt. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
Okay.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down at the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November came early. The ship was the pride of the American side, coming back from some mill in Wisconsin. As the big freighters go, it was bigger than most, with a crew and good captain well seasoned.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today Jay Platt is here in the studio. Jay is the owner and bookseller at Westside Bookshop. And a shout out to Doug Price, who has like the back room there with the beautiful photography and so many interesting art books as well.
Right.
Typewriters, for sure. Jay, thanks for choosing the music for today's program. And we just got to hear Jason played some Gordon Lightfoot, the Edmund Fitzgerald. For the song, I was thinking it was because of your naval architecture degree and your interest in boat building and boats and sailing.
Oh, yeah.
But this is another, it resonates even more, this song.
Yes. Yes, it does. And, you know, because I was, even growing up in Alexandria, I was always interested in the Great Lakes and Great Lakes shipping. And I remember when the Carl D. Bradley went down in 1958 when I was in high school. And I clipped out all the articles in the Washington papers about it. Then in 1966, the Daniel J. Morrell sank. That was my senior year in naval architecture. And then the Fitzgerald went down, but there hasn't been one since. So it used to be like every 10 years there would be a major storm. And anyway.
And the Edmund Fitzgerald went down, you said, when?
Well, November 10th or 12th, I forget, 1975.
So right after.
Which is right after I opened the bookshop. Yeah.
The bookshop, yeah. Well, thanks for choosing the songs for today.
Okay.
I often that song haunts me. I went to the, have you been to the Shipwreck Museum up in
Whitefish Point?
At
yes.
Whitefish Point, yeah.
Yeah, oh yes.
If you're in, they've got the song on the loop, or at least they used to, so it can really get in your head.
Yes, okay, oh, it's on the loop, yeah.
So that's a bit of a warning for folks if you don't want something stuck in your head, but it's a very cool museum.
Yes, it is.
And such a beautiful Whitefish Point. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the colors of the sunset. Over the lakes. Well, Jay. So let's go back inside West Side Bookshop. Today is a wonderful day to walk into the bookshop.
Okay.
And so, you've been there 50 years. You built bookshelves in the front room, and you gradually had to keep expanding.
Yes.
The front room was, you know, full with books, and so you had to move into the middle room.
Right? Yes, in the middle room and the back room. This was before Doug started working with me, but still, we didn't start with that when we opened. I think we had maybe 3,000. I bought one collection right after I opened, or just before I opened. So we had maybe 3,500 books or something like that when we opened. And now I think when you have a bookshop, an open bookshop, that you're going to get books going to be coming. I think some dealers are always afraid they're going to run out of books, but nope, not going
to
happen.
Do people even bring them to you every day?
Yeah, people bring them in. But as I said before, that I buy estates.
Yes.
From people are moving or trying to settle an estate and things like that.
How many books do you think you have now, Jay? I know you won't.
I've never done an inventory, but it's probably about 25,000 or something like that. You know, in that range. I've got books in the basement, which I do. We sell some online, but it's not a big part of the business. Most of it's through the bookshop, and I do travel around doing antiquarian book fairs around the country, in Boston, Washington, D.C., Florida.
What's the community like, Jay, for the antiquarian bookseller community?
It's a pretty small group. I mean, we're lucky in Ann Arbor. We have more book dealers, used book dealers, than certainly any city of comparable size, and more than a lot of much bigger cities. So we're lucky in that respect. But the members of the trade, we call it the trade, are there's an organization called the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, the ABAA. I mean, there's about 450 members. And these are people that do it full time. And not everyone. Now, there are a lot more dealers that are not members. But still, I don't know how many book dealers are, but it's not, maybe there are 1,000. I don't know. I mean, we kind of know each other, especially people. I mean, I can, it's a small group.
And so people are still getting the bug for it.
Oh, yes.
Do you think it's even maybe more important now where people are understanding about material culture, like things like maybe the shine is wearing off some of the digital landscape?
I think so. I think books are – one thing I tell people when I sometimes give talks on book collecting, I said, here's a technology – that if you go back 500 years, what's called the book. I mean, before that, there was scrolls and things like that. But the book form is called a codex. And that goes back to, maybe as far as 1,000 years ago. But the first printed book, of course, was in 1456 at Gutenberg Bible. But you could go back, someone from 500 years ago could look at a modern book and know what it is and know what to do with it. And conversely, we can go take a book that's 500 years old and you know what it is.
Yes, you might not be able to
use it.
You know how to use it. You might not be able to read it, but you could
plug it in.
You don't need something else to get it to work.
There's something about that, I think I, excuse me, I had a conversation, Borders Bookshop started here in 1971 as a used bookstore. And they had their first shop was about half the size of my front room. And I was one of their first customers. And so I've known the Border Brothers, since then, but I remember Tom Borders told me once, he said, if you don't like handling books, physically handling books, you can't be a bookseller. I mean, just like handling them, shelving them.
The artifact of the book. That it's physical presence in your hands.
Yeah.
Well, and Jay, you've bought books today. So what do you have on the table? Because these are going to the Antiquarian Book Fair this Sunday.
Yeah, I'm
going to
have these here. One of the books I brought was a copy of The Phantom of the Opera by Gaston Leroux. And this particular edition, it was first published in 1911. And in the 1920s, there was a movie made of The Phantom of the Opera. And the publisher of this book is Grosset and Dunlap, and they did what are called photoplay editions. So they're photos of the play, of the movie, and there are a couple of color, full-page color plates in there. So this is from about 1925. And if that copy had a dust jacket, it would be worth 10 times what I have on it.
Really?
Yeah.
So those things like the dust jacket.
Dust jacket makes that's a very, certain books Yeah, like that. Yeah.
The color plates, she's yeah. staggered swooning, page 73. Yeah. Beautiful, like oil paintings.
Yeah.
Jay, just so everyone, you can know, like, kindly let me hold the book yeah, okay. and look at it. But I do realize, like, as I was taking it from you, I didn't want to open it all the way. I was suddenly very careful, as you were saying, 1925
yeah.
edition,
yeah.
and that you're going to be selling it this yes. Sunday, too.
Yeah.
You know, where did you find that one, Jay?
Well, someone brought it in.
Oh, okay.
In the shop. And, you know, books are pretty sturdy things. I mean, you know, some books are fragile, but some people... You know, these books have been around. I mean, books, I've handled books from in the 1500s. Actually, the oldest book I had, a printed book, was from 1494, something like that.
Wow.
Which is called Incunabula, and books printed roughly in the first 50 years of printing. And Incunabula means swaddling clothes. They said the birth of printing. So any book published before 1500 or 1501, I think is the actual date, is valuable just because of its age.
Yes. Oh.
Which is not true of all old books. A lot of old books are not valuable at all. And, you know, some old books for two or three hundred years don't have much value.
Really? I would think anything would be.
No. No. Well, anyway.
Well, I would be wrong.
There's some. And, of course, some new books have become quite valuable. And I brought another one here. Here's a book of poetry by Seamus Heaney.
Oh, Heaney.
And it's signed, inscribed by him. And it's a nice copy in dust jacket. And just as an aside, I would say at the book fair this coming Sunday, one of the dealers specializes in modern poetry. And we'll have a lot of very interesting books.
And will you be bringing the polar exploration books, and what other dealers with their specialties will be there, Jay, off the top of your head?
Well, some of the dealers will specialize in, as one dealer specializes, a lot of children's books will be there. Some dealers specialize in science fiction, a lot of modern first editions. There should be some art books there. Pretty wide variety of books, yes.
And this will be in the ballroom on the second floor of the Michigan Union on Sunday. Could I read the inscription for you?
Oh, okay, yeah.
To Zibby and Bob, sing yourselves to where the singing comes from. Page 439. Wish you were here. Seamus Heaney, Dublin, Thanksgiving Day, 1998.
Yeah.
Wow.
Anyway.
I love that he put the page number
Good. Zibby O'Neill was an author here in town. I mean, she wrote children's books and some other, you know. Anyway, the other book I brought, and I, as I've mentioned before, I do specialize in books on the polar regions, and I brought a copy of a book called South by Sir Ernest Shackleton, and it's about his expedition of crossing. What they set out to do was to cross the Antarctic continent. I mean, the Antarctic continent. The pole had been reached, so the other quest would be to cross it. So he got a ship called the Endurance. Got a crew. They sailed down. They got caught in the ice in the Weddell Sea, and eventually, long story shorter. The Endurance, got crushed in the ice. Excuse me. And they had to save what they could. And they hauled it, and they took the lifeboats, and they were called manhauling. They hauled them across the ice with his, you know, food and things like that. And they'd set camps occasionally. When they reached open water, they got on the boats and they sailed to Elephant Island, which is off the Antarctic Peninsula. And here they were, that no one knew where they were, because he did not take a radio along, because he did not want people to risk their lives trying to rescue them. So here they were. Nobody knew where they were. And people, you know, and also this was during World War I, too. Excuse me.
Jay, we'll take a short break, a really short break. Today on Living Writers, Jay Platt is here. West Side Bookshops, 50 years old. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back. Welcome back. You're just in time for the last part of Living Writers today with Jay Platt, the owner and bookseller at West Side Bookshop here in Ann Arbor. West Side Bookshop is 50 years old and counting. And this coming Sunday is the Antiquarian Book Fair at Michigan Union. You can find Jay there and the West Side Bookshop and many other antiquarian book dealers. Jay, so we're just talking about the book on the table before break, South. Could you keep telling us about, yes, we were there with the Endurance.
Okay, the ship had been totally lost. It was totally on their own. They were on Elephant Island. But they had to get word out to the outside world where they were. So Shackleton and four others took one of the lifeboats. They had the carpenter on board, you know, refitted it. For ocean travel, they had to sail from Elephant Island to South Georgia, about 800 miles. And they had to navigate with the weather was terrible. This is some of the stormiest oceans in the world. And they were able to cross, what they had to do. They had to make sure they could hit Elephant Island. And a lot of time they couldn't see the sun to make a sight with her. You know. But if they missed Elephant Island, if they missed South Georgia, the boat was, you know, it wasn't very efficient. It couldn't sail back against the wind. So they had to make sure they hit it, and they did. And then they had to cross South Georgia to reach a whaling station called Grivetkin, and they had to cross a mountain range, but had not been traversed before. So they got there. They went back and rescued the men, and they sailed. The Chilean Navy helped them, went back, and they picked up all the men. Not one life was lost. And it's an incredible story, and this is Shackleton's account of it in a book called South. And this is the first American edition of it.
Could I take a look while you're telling us, Jay? Yeah. It's a beautiful book. It's hefty.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was it's an incredible story.
It's lovely when you buy a book like this. This was published in, do you remember off the top of your head when it was published?
1920.
1920. Of course you do. Of course you know. But you get to see like that. In some ways, the history of the book, where it's been before, like you open the book here and it says David M. Payne, like in this beautiful, like old script handwriting that people don't write like this anymore. You see a little old Eagle bookshop in Kennebunkport, Maine, with like books, old glass and china and with the address. It's sort of wonderful to see the story of the book as well as what the story of Shackleton is telling here, which is incredible. So this one is part of your, is there a fold out map too? I'm just looking towards the back here. Oh, wow. So this book also has, I won't do it just in case. I don't want to.
Yeah.
I won't risk it, everyone. But it's a fold-out map. It's a beautiful book.
Oh yeah.
And this one will be at the Antiquarian Book Fair.
So
how
indeed.
Do you know you're ready to part with South?
Oh, I always like to bring enough polar material
because
that's
represent.
What I specialize. People
right.
know. And It doesn't sell as well. I mean, well, I shouldn't say that.
I'm glad my brother's not going to be there. He would be buying up the shop, I think.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Well, get him over here.
Okay, Eric Hetzel, we'll get you on a flight.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, maybe back to West Side Bookshop, just because it's 50th birthday.
Yeah.
Are there going to be celebrations? Because you mentioned that the day of opening was a bit of a celebration in and of itself,
right.
And all your friends came. And
yeah.
Are there? Oh, and Jay, it's okay if you've already had the party and I wasn't invited.
No. No. Yeah, I was going to do something, but I said, no, I get so busy with the upcoming book fair or something. But anyway, so. But I'm still, actually, word has gotten out, so I do get people commenting on it. That's why I'm here, too.
Maybe it could be just the whole year. We'll just keep it going.
Yeah,
people can bring cupcakes and other treats to West Side Bookshop. No one will be turned away.
Yeah.
Jay, you were mentioning there's been so many stories through the year that have happened in this bookshop. Could you tell us some of the standout moments for you?
Yeah, back in the 1980s, woman comes into bookshop and asks if I have any books by Jack Kerouac. I said, well, I don't have much. I might have a paperback.
And on the road, maybe.
Yeah. And she said, well, I'm Jack Kerouac's first wife. Edie Parker was her name. And she I knew enough about Jack. I read an autobiography. I knew the Kerouac story. And he was she was from Grosse Pointe. But they met in New York, and she was an art student there. And she claimed, and I think it's true, that she's the one who introduced Kerouac to Ginsberg, Burroughs, people like that. That she was
because she was the artist.
Yeah, and she was a more outgoing, and Jack Kerouac was pretty shy.
Oh,
so according, you know, and anyway, so she came in, and she said, "Well, I've got letters from Jack Kerouac. I've got, paint." I said, would you like to do something in the bookshop? So we had her in and one evening, and she brought, as I said, letters from Jack Kerouac. And they kept in touch to a degree. But she didn't, you know, she was a little strange sometimes. But she said, you know, I didn't really know he was that famous. But she had all these, and they kept corresponding until he died. And I wrote a letter. Just because he died in St. Petersburg, Florida, he got in a fight or something, and he claimed that somebody, you know, punched him in the gut or something. And but he wrote a letter about that just before he died to her. So they kept in touch to a degree. But she also brought in some paintings that he'd done, which I don't think anybody knew about. I'd never heard of it before, and we had her come in a second time too. So, but that was just, you know, right out of the blue, she came in. And she also told me that she had a manuscript. Jack Kerouac, they lived in Grosse Pointe for a while, and they would come to Ann Arbor. And she had relatives in Dexter, and I think his first book called The Town and the City, which a lot of people thought was based in Lowell, Massachusetts, which is where Jack Kerouac grew up. She said, no, it's most about Ann Arbor and Dexter. That's what it was based on.
Huh.
Now, I haven't read Town in the City, so I can't say that. Yeah. But, I mean, it obviously didn't use that name or anything. But she said that's where the inspiration came from, which is interesting.
Yeah. It makes it for a good story, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that feels like one of the big moments. With the shop, probably every day, there's like the daily smaller moments with people coming in and young and old.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we get people, and a lot of people travel. I mean, a lot of people, oh, I'm coming into the bookshop. This is my first stop when I'm visiting Ann Arbor. And I'm sure they say that about other places, too. But
maybe not.
Still, maybe not. I don't know. But I don't get as many students as I used to, I think. I mean, and professors that you don't buy as many books. I remember, this is kind of an aside, but I was up in East Lansing buying a collection from this retired professor. And he was almost 100 years old when I bought the books. But he's, And I went to his house, bought books, and I went to his office. And I was walking by the other offices, and they didn't have books in there. Excuse me.
Oh, my goodness. That's yeah, shocking.
Said, what's going on? And they said, that's all I can tell you. Somebody else said, professors don't buy as many books as they used to.
I don't know. Not the ones I know, Jay.
I'm sorry?
Not the ones I know. Don't.
Okay,
don't,
good. Yeah. Good. Yeah, but it's a, anyway.
I think when I first really met you, I brought my first writing class
you
to
did.
West Side Bookshop.
I still have that someplace. She said they signed a thank you note.
It was so kind of you to host us like a writing 100 class.
Yeah.
And some of the students, they thought it was a museum. And
well, sometimes I feel that myself. I think people come in and they don't think it's a bookshop. Maybe it's a museum. I should thank you.
Well, it is.
No, like thank you by buying some books.
Yeah, yes. And it's so beautiful. I think that might be what it is. You walk in and you feel like you're in a different world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a big believer in open bookshops. I mean, because I think that's how people realize that you can buy used books and things like that. And that's how we get started. And I said, oh, this is really interesting. That's how I got started, you know, walking into a bookshop. And so if you lose that, it's, I mean, you can do it online, but that's not different. You walk in to a bookshop and see all these books. The possibilities are limitless.
Completely. Because you don't know what you're going to see. You know, and it doesn't, and some of the, at West Side Bookshop, what I also love is sometimes even the pathways get narrower.
Yeah.
Because there's stacks of books as their shelves, they're piled on the shelves, there's.
Yeah.
And that's like something where.
And I said, I tell people, oh, I'm way behind on shelving. You said, that's okay. We just like to hunt.
It's true, because then you don't know. You find strange things next to each other.
Yeah.
And it's.
Oh, right. It's kind of serendipity. And, you know, people come in. You know, some people, they ask for one book. Okay, and then they don't have it, they walk out. But I want someone to come in and browse.
Yes.
And I can tell when someone is really interested. And they'll spend maybe an hour or two.
Yeah, you know. Maybe they'll get the bug.
Yeah. So there you go.
Jay Platt, thank you so much for today. And thank you so much for creating the space, West Side Bookshop, that's such an important place in Ann Arbor, a community place. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, T. Thank you very much.
Jay Platt, everyone, from West Side Bookshop, the Antiquarian Book Fair this Sunday at the Michigan Union. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks to Jason for engineering. Thanks to Mom out there for listening. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
Okay.
Four strong winds that blow lonely, seven seas that run high, all those things that don't change, come what may. But our good times are all gone, and I'm bound for moving on.
In a world of pop radio and plastic pop hits.
'Cause baby, firework.
One station fears no format. WCBN FM Ann Arbor, where our form is always free. Tune in for the best jazz. Hip hop. Rock. And weird stuff you won't hear anywhere else.
Rock over London, rock on Chicago.
Broadcasting live 24/7. WCBN FM Ann Arbor at WCBN.org or 88.3 on the dial. Turn it to the left and rip the knob off.
Here's the report from the world of sports on WCPN.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Sports Report. My name is Zach Warshaw. We have a full panel for our Hockey Wednesday. Normally, it's just me and Vihan Iswar, but today we're joined by Caleb Brown, Charlie Mitchell, and Max Wood, all to join us to talk about a little Michigan hockey and then look into the NHL as well, as we're now 5 to 6 games into the season, depending on which team you follow. First of all, thank you for joining me, everybody. I really appreciate it, as always.
Yeah, Vihan Iswar is still here, if that was not made clear by the introduction.
Don't worry, I would never miss you, Vihan. Don't worry about it.
Thank you.
So first, let's start with Michigan. Obviously, coming off the Robert Morris series,